the largest chains of hospitals in New Jersey. The last time I looked, there were 18 executives of Robert Wood Johnson Barnabas, all of whom were earning salaries of over $1 million a year, beginning with the chairman, Barry Ostrowski, who earned $5.6 million a year. This is a chain of multi-millionaire executives that is a so-called nonprofit chain, and yet they are trying to bulldoze a community of low-income immigrants who are making $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a year and don't even have the ability to vote to try to be able to affect the education of their children. This is a David and Goliath battle, and we know what happened with David and Goliath. We'll see what happens with this Cancer Institute.
Well, Juan, thanks so much for that. Juan Cartagena, President and General Counsel of Latino Justice, we also want to thank you, representing parents, students and taxpayers in New Brunswick, New Jersey, who oppose the demolition of the Lincoln Annex Public School. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Be safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio.
And it looks like that's my cue. This is Paul Rowan. Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am talking to you from my home here in Southeast Portland. And I've got on the other line, hopefully, my co-host, John from Portland Assembly. You with us, John?
Indeed. Good morning, Paul. It's good to hear you.
Good to hear you. And we, this is a regular third Wednesday show. Often I have Sarah. I used to have you and Sarah, and sometimes MK. But things have changed, and we are reduced in our capacities, but we're still have a strong signal, and we still have important things to talk about. Today, we're going to be talking about continued resistance during this pandemic and not leaving the field open just to these liberate people who are challenging the stay-at-home orders and liberate. God, how about co-opting terminology right there? And we're going to be talking about Jamie Partridge, I believe, is going to be calling in maybe about 15 minutes. We're going to be talking about the solidarity with postal, grocery, and hospital essential workers, car caravan tomorrow morning. And we're going to be talking about Squat PDX, and we're going to be talking about the continuing favoritism shown towards the billionaires and other capitalist elites who rule our lives with their vast wealth, and more continues to go to them during these with these bailouts. So with that, Jonathan, what's on your mind these days?
Well, you kind of nailed it. I think, if anything, it's a real bit of irony that our own homegrown real estate fascist-leaning instigator, Joey Gibson, had his kid up on the internet with that very awful, ironic flyer that I think just said, "Work makes you free." I know we've all heard that before. But, yeah, we're literally at the point now where we're openly talking about in mainstream discussion the fact that capitalism is running on blood, and right now this is a push to continue that, and it's going to come down on, you know, the most marginalized people as it always has. And they're already seeing this in huge numbers of disparity in the South and elsewhere, where Black and brown and indigenous people are all being affected by this crisis as we speak. way more harshly than any of these people who are trying to reopen the economy. So it's obviously biased. It's obviously a paradigm that is not a precedent we want to, you know, lose ground on, I suppose. So these new inventive ways of resisting and sheltering in place are going to become the new normal, hopefully. I mean, at least we'll figure out a better way to get an edge on these folks, but they're really pushing for opening the economy again.
And of course, you know, there's the whole term opening the economy. We could talk about the whole show. What is the economy after all, and who is it for? But before we dive into all that, let me just, before Jamie calls in, I just want to read real briefly, and he's going to talk about it more in depth. The solidarity with postal, grocery, and hospital essential workers. It's tomorrow, May 21st. Gather at 9 a.m. at the East Portland Post Office, 1020 Southeast 7th Avenue, to decorate the cars. 9:30, circle the post office as workers load their vehicles. In solidarity with them, as there's a serious effort to try to shut down the postal service in a time when we most desperately need it to have any kind of semblance of fair elections. After that, people are going to be going to the Fred Meyer at Southeast Hawthorne, and then the Providence Hospital at Northeast Gleason. And, well, I'll just let Jamie talk about what the reasons are for it, as he will be able to do in about 10 minutes. And, yeah, go ahead. What's on your plate in terms of resistance these days?
Well, as everyone's aware, platforms like Zoom and Jitsi are becoming everyone's daily organizing life. So the virtualization continues for sure. But it's nice, if only because it has given a lot of momentum to more national movements and their kind of coalescence around certain ideals. I know you've gotten to cover the rent strike a bit. There's some updates there as far as how folks are organizing to resist this upcoming wave that's inevitable, because we're looking at very temporary, you know, measures in place to prevent the evictions that are going to come from this massive layoff. Like 26 million people or something applied for unemployment one day. These are unprecedented numbers of unemployment, and they're definitely going to translate to a mismatch in the price signaling, quote unquote, of these rentals and of these existing leases people are holding that they're all going to infringe on. So there's definitely been a lot of movement towards a community-based eviction defense network. And I think that is a good precedent to set, especially when we look back at what happened with Moms for Housing in February, as we covered before, where basically the Alameda Sheriff's Department showed up full riot gear, full tanks, just to clear out these moms and their children from this bank-owned home that they had decided to enter in the middle of the winter to shelter themselves. And then lo and behold, right after all that, this crisis breaks out, and it kind of highlights the problem even more so. And nothing changed in that time, you know what I mean? The bankers are still crunching away, trying to make money off the rents. Everyone's trying to continue business as usual, even though effectively this has proven out that an entire sector of the economy has evaporated because it hasn't been invested in as far as the infrastructure to support it. There's no medical systems to support it. There's not enough ventilators in the whole country, right? Like, we are running into these production problems. And there is at least a good kind of movement towards these five demands, the global demands. I don't know if you've kept up with that at all, but immunity for all seems to be the good thing, or along with housing for all, and housing being a human right. But free health care, no work, no paying, no debt, free the prisoners, and homes for all seem to be the big points of resistance that a lot of different orgs are coalescing around.
Let's talk about the rent strike. I re-injured an old back injury for the 100th time and was kind of out of commission. And I finally took my first bike ride in a few weeks and went along the 205 trail, which is, if you want to get one place to get a glimpse of the housing situation, dismal housing situation in Portland, is to go there. There's unfortunately many, many places to go, almost not that many places where you won't see tents set up where people are doing the best they can to survive in the midst of both the pandemic and the latest capitalist crisis. So I got the feeling that there's more people out there already, which is no surprise. Is that so that's something that hasn't really been talked about, the how this crisis is affecting the houseless population. So I want to talk a little bit about that and what is going on with the rent strike in Portland, as far as you know.
For sure. And I'm not necessarily as directly involved with it right now, but I know that Right Survive and other orgs like This Is the Road and so on have supported the formation of a Stop the Sweeps coalition that's actively working to address sheltering in place for houseless individuals. I know that there's been a huge dearth in the available hygiene facilities. Since all of these businesses have closed, it effectively has made life on the streets almost impossible in Portland, just because we're now talking about access to water. And so one of the things immediately that people had to start doing when they were shifting their services was doing direct service, because you can't justify coming into town or using the transit or anything like that because of social distancing and people being concerned. So it's a lot harder to stay safe if you don't have shelter, for one. And then also the actual physical access to resources has now been cut off because all these businesses you used to be able to go get a glass of water at are no longer serving. And so there's been a huge shift in the urgency of different kinds of needs, especially medications and so on, where you can't just drop by and get that kind of thing. As where it used to be, people could kind of scrape by and there was enough of a social net to keep people going. Now that that's just shut down, anyone who's kind of socially disenfranchised is at a huge disadvantage right now, to the point that it is urgent. Urgent problems are emerging. And how that relates to the rent strike is that everybody who can't pay rent now realizes very viscerally, I feel, that they are right there with these people. And maybe this will be the change. Maybe this will be the catalyst to really lay bare that none of us on this productive end of the capital market are capitalists. Even if you support it, even if you're pro-business, blah, blah, if you have a mortgage or if you have debt or if you have any of that, you are literally a body that provides wealth to these private equity investors, and that's it. And so the second that we're not useful to them anymore because they are the whole of the productive economy, the market won't care. And you'll see it. So the market not caring about us as people means that people are on the street, which is why a lot of the retaliation, a lot of the answers seem to be coming from people who've been historically disenfranchised by the real estate market, taking back space for themselves to shelter in place, to provide hygiene, food, and water access basics, very, very basic. So we're seeing that there's this underlying ethical problem with our productive economy, that it won't line up with anything people really need in times of crisis. And then, in fact, ever. Because there is a crisis ongoing as long as capitalism's been around. But now it's spreading. And now it is becoming a larger percentage of the population, and the margins have widened. So people have to take notice. With respect to the rent strike, that I think means that people are going to start to take notice that this is a broken system and there's no real effective way to work this out, because the productive sectors that people used to involve themselves with their whole career, I got a ton of friends who are career bartenders and so on. There's no real prospect for them to ever be able to make as much money as they were possibly able to make before. So how are they ever supposed to afford rent or pay any of this back? Like, the whole question assumes that we're going to be able to get back to some kind of normal, and that's just impossible, logistically impossible. So rent striking is no longer becoming just an inevitability because people can't pay. It's kind of becoming a more conscious movement, it seems, especially when you look at Moms for Housing again, because they so perfectly, in my opinion, encapsulated the problem with the evicted speculators tag, because it's really hard to explain to people what's going on as far as how they're gambling with the land price, and that causes gentrification because the city buys into this future that they sell them every time. And it always produces the same kind of displacement. It's always inherently anti-black displacement at its root, and it comes from urban renewal and all the way back to the displacement of indigenous peoples. The mechanism has been the same. And so now this rent strike movement kind of is an opportunity to realign that power dynamic, because so many people are now inherently squatting. And that's why I've been personally very interested in watching Squat PDX's page. I do hope they get the call in, but if not, go check them out. I found out through Youth Liberation Front, I think, had posted something of theirs, but they got it right. They understand this is an all-out shift that we have to make, because housing is a human right. The market's not going to solve itself. Even Adam Smith knew that. And so taking back space is going to be the question. And sheltering in place is the platform that I think people are really getting onto to recognize that.
So have you heard of any active housing occupations at AKA squats in the Portland area?
It's happening inevitably. I know that people probably notice that there's more and more commercial leases that are going bust as well. It's almost something that has always been around, but now is becoming topical. So yeah, there's a ton. If you look, you can see it. I mean, everybody knows the squatter symbol, that N with a little pointy arrow on top. Everyone sees it around. Like, it's kind of an international symbol to demonstrate that this is a free run property, right? That this is something that has been taken back from the owners to be used for people's common good and public access in a way that if you recognize what's going on, you can use it. So it's a symbol that I think is going to become more popular as well, because people start to recognize that means I can get resources here, and people recognize the problem. And so I do know that's happening. I have seen some. I don't know any actively that are networking together, but I do think that that's going to be the shift. I think there's going to be inherently that kind of solidarity with those folks. So I'm very interested in that. I'm very interested in seeing a renter squatter alliance, but obviously, like, that's for people to, you know, decide on their own. But I think it's going to happen.
So people can go to Squat PDX is a Facebook site, and we can resume this conversation. I believe maybe Jamie Partridge has called in. I asked him to call around at 8:15. Is he on the line, Ty?
No call yet.
Nope. Okay. Well, we'll just hold tight until Jamie calls us up. So, you know, this is a really important issue. I follow, you know, these conversations. And one, you know, a big one that comes up is, you know, people saying that, well, you know, there's a lot of people who just own one or two rental properties, and they, you know, they found that niche, that opportunity within the capitalist system to, supplement their income, and it becomes, you know, an important part of their income. And so there's a lot of people are pushing back. You know, people may not have an overall, you know, because it's hard to have an overall economic analysis. We're so fragmented. We're so individualized. We're so really bought into the framework of the existing property relations that it's hard to see beyond that to some kind of vision of a society where we're not captive to those dynamics. And so, you know, it's hard to bring people in who aren't maybe directly faced with, you know, and even then, people are mostly scrambling just to pay their rent. I'd say that's probably a much larger share of people who are just doing whatever they can to pay their rent instead of making this, you know, risky gesture of engaging in a rent strike in the hopes that enough people do it that it creates some kind of momentum in which there's eventually something more can happen. I'm sure you can talk better on that than I am able to.
We have Jamie on the line.
Well, before you go, keep that on hold, John, and let's hear what Jamie has to say. Jamie, good morning.
Good morning, Paul. Can you hear me?
Oh yeah, loud and clear. So talk about this car caravan, this exciting moment of actual resistance going on in the midst of this pandemic.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about opening up the economy. Well, the essential workers never went home. They've been out there on the front lines serving the public in various ways. And tomorrow we're talking specifically about postal workers, grocery workers, and hospital workers who have been basically risking their health and their lives to continue serving, continue working, conserving, you know, serving the public in indispensable ways. And, you know, their struggle has been for appropriate, you know, personal protective equipment, for adequate social distancing and sufficient disinfecting in their workplaces. And at the same time, and their employers and government are undercutting and attacking their very livelihoods, their ability to feed their families and their and to pay their rent. And what we're doing with this car caravan is to show them some respect and draw some attention, the solidarity from the public, their allies, as well as trying to put pressure on their employers and the government to provide for them and their families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's we're Jonathan and I were talking earlier about how the, you know, these protests to against the stay-at-home orders that are going on around the country seem to be kind of have captured the media attention of the idea of resistance. And so maybe talk about the importance of, you know, this kind of demonstration in that situation.
Yeah, it's especially important, I think, to do visible out in the public protest demonstrations, rallies, to counter the media narrative of that the people who are active and trying to influence the direction of what's happening to us are only these right-wing, this right-wing coalition of Trumpsters and, you know, open the economy folks. And so it's really important for those of us who can get out to stage appropriate, in this case, we're in cars, socially distanced and wearing masks, but other ways of protesting and raising the level of struggle and the visibility, in this case of the and I can talk specifically about what's happening with all these different workforces if you like.
Well, start with the Postal Service. I know that's something very close to your experience and your heart, and is something
sure.
increasingly and incredibly important with the threats to the whole election process. I just read that I think it was Michigan decided that they would mail out ballots to everybody in August or something, and Trump immediately pushed back, saying, you know, claiming that there would be massive voter fraud. And just, yeah, talk about the importance of the Postal Service, both for elections and just, you know, in general, in the current situation where people depend upon receiving things at our homes.
Yeah, certainly. The Oregon's experience, of course, we were the first to go all vote by mail, and our experience has shown that it clearly increases voter turnout, and it offers there isn't voter fraud or in the Oregon system. And of course, what Trump is afraid of is that with more voter turnout, there will be more votes against him and his program. And he even said that very explicitly, you know, that if this bill that is on its way through Congress, well, that passed the House and it's probably stalled in the Senate, passes, all voters in November will have access to vote by mail and the Republicans will lose. Vote by mail is just one of the many things that the Postal Service accomplishes. One of the most important things that the Postal Service does in serving everyone equally, universal service at universal reasonable rates from everywhere from the outback in Alaska to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, is medications. The Veterans Hospital, all of their medications they send by mail you know, seniors, rural communities especially depend on the mail. Small businesses, lots of home at home businesses ship and receive through the mail, and of course, the census is accomplished through the mail. The testing that we're going to all need for this COVID virus is going to be accomplished through the mail, the self-testing, and of course, when the vaccine comes out, there's a very high likelihood that the mail will be that system. So it's a tried and true infrastructure that is not only in a perilous situation because of the COVID pandemic itself. I mean, we've already lost about 65 postal workers across the country to the COVID virus, and about 12,000 people are either in quarantine or infected or in quarantine, and whole systems, postal systems, have shut down, particularly New York City and Detroit, where there were some neighborhoods that weren't getting mail for weeks because so many people were out sick. In Michigan, they were delivering mail every other day for a while, but more importantly, right now, the postal systems are because of all the closures and the crash of the economy, mail volume has crashed to it's about down about 30% now. It'll be down about 50% this summer, and the Postal Board of Governors. The Postmaster General says that the Postal Service will run out of money by the fall, which is a perfect setup for the Trump administration's agenda, which is to privatize the Postal Service, to sell it off to, their cronies on Wall Street. And that's another one of the main focus of our rally on tomorrow morning, which is Save the Postal Service. It needs an infusion of $25 billion to be able to survive through this year, and whatever it takes between the difference between costs and revenue in the coming period.
Yeah, the vulture funds are licking their chops at the prospect, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, it's a $70 billion business. It's a profitable business, and of course, privatization would mean prices would go up. The people in the rural areas would pay more, and of course, service would go down. The mail would be delivered every other day or whatever. And of course, union busting, and it would no longer be a good union represented, well paid, well benefited job.
Jonathan, go ahead. You wanted to ask some.
Oh, well, I mean, just hearing all that back really highlights to me that this is a great example of why the rationality of productive economics will bankrupt us socially at any given point of crisis. Or it's inherently fascist. And why is it inherently fascist? It's because what these people are doing by going out into the economy unmasked in groups and so on is basically flagrantly disregarding those who do not have the same access to your healthcare and wealth and anything in the productive economy that they do. So this is literally a coalition of capitalist owner class type people actively warring against the more vulnerable classes of people in the same society. So they're doing this antagonistically, intentionally, because they believe in eugenic type behavior. They're literally offering up people who they believe are not worth living in order to continue their productive desires. And so this is just laying bare that this is how it's always been. And when you start to talk about privatization, especially when we look at Allende and how the CIA had murdered Allende in order to install Pinochet, and how that whole program was run by the Chicago Boys, and they went down there and basically made the economy scream, quote unquote, to get things done. It kind of highlights how the economy itself is a military strategy and a weapon, And so this type of demonstration, like Save the Postal Worker, Save the Post Office, like they're the only reason these systems have ever maintained is because of resistance. It's not because of the benevolence of capitalism. It's because people needed them and fought for them. And so this is another wave of that. And effectively, this is the fight against eugenics. You know what I mean? This is a fight against that style of expansionist capitalist attitude of manifest destiny. The same idea.
So there's a Facebook page if people want more information. Just a solidarity with postal, grocery, and hospital essential workers. Give people an idea. Repeat, you know, where and when to meet and what they should expect if they want to be part of this.
Sure. And let me just quickly say that on the grocery worker side, well, I'll just walk you through it. We're gathering at 9 at the East Portland Post Office, 1020 Southeast 7th. That's between Belmont and Hawthorne on 7th at 9. And then we'll start, and we'll be decorating our cars with signs and banners, and then circle that post office as the letter carriers are loading up their vehicles and, you know, honking and cheering them and their work and putting forward the message to save our postal service, and then heading up Hawthorne to Fred Meyer's at 38th and Hawthorne and circling that parking lot as the workers come outside to, not only in solidarity with them on the front lines, but to reinstate hazard pay for Fred Meyer workers. Fred Meyer's has jerked their hazard pay as of last Saturday, apparently they think that there's no longer a hazard for these workers. In any case, then we go Cesar Chavez over to Northeast, Widler 30th and Widler to the Fred Meyer over there, circle their parking lot, and so workers come outside, and then on to Legacy Emmanuel Hospital at about 10:30, where the hospital workers are also struggling for hazard pay and safe staffing. And as we know, hospital workers in particular have been on the front line of the pandemic and their struggle for personal protective equipment and sufficient social distancing and disinfecting. But we hope folks can come out and participate, and of course and we want to make sure that folks stay safe and come in a car or come with someone who has a car.
So you're saying that people should bring masks, and if they want to make signs and banners in advance, they could probably do that as well.
Please, yes, we will have signs and banners and the ability to make them there, but also we encourage people to come with their own.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jamie Partridge, for that update. Any final thoughts?
Solidarity with postal, grocery, and hospital essential workers.
Tomorrow right on, morning. And that's a tomorrow, East Portland Post Office, 1020 Southeast 7th Avenue. Thank you so much, Jamie.
9 a.m. Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Okay. And
8 a.m. was that the time?
9 a.m. And something you can do safely in your car. And be interesting if to get a whole bunch of people. As you know, I was thinking as we're talking about this, the idea of sort of media spectacle protests is something that I've participated in I don't know, maybe hundreds in my life, and willingly and with, often with enthusiasm, because, they make you, feel strength in numbers. B, they, have a certain impact. And sometimes, they can actually add up to something important. But now, since we're all so much at home and consuming a lot of media, the impact of these things is I think even greater. So I don't know, this is an interesting time we're living in, and interesting to have things to do. So again, that's tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. I won't say anything more. I will just say there's a Facebook page again, Solidarity with Postal, Grocery, and Hospital Essential Workers. So, yeah, I don't know if you remember what we were talking about before, but this whole idea of you know, the difficulty of breaking out of our individualized consciousnesses and the difficulty of forming strong solidarity in not just in the time of pandemic but under capitalism in general, and the difficulty of feeling like what you do actually can make a difference in, you know, the idea of taking risks, which I guess not paying one's rent is a risk. Want to talk more about that?
Oh, for sure. I think that is directly related to you. This entire question has now come to the topic of work itself, which I think is important, if only because if we look at the history of compulsory work, it is directly based on the plantation model set up our current wage system, right? The first wages were given to freedmen who were former slaves, and they were basically a way in which you could be disenfranchised from having to pay for the livelihood of your slave class. And so that history doesn't just go away. In fact, it's kind of doubled down and expanded and reconstituted itself. And so the essential worker question, because I'm technically an essential worker, I'm a white-collar worker, and they're making the people who work in the factory with me also work. And yeah, somewhere, sometimes one of our subsidiary branches builds medical equipment. But when we start to look at these designations of essential worker or not, you can even start to see that these have little to do with the question of safety and more about the question of which of these companies can afford to do that as far as convince the government one way or another. So there's already a kind of consolidation and favoritism built into that selection bias that you can't just ignore. And so who is essential or not isn't even decided by any of the working class and any of the people who are actually on the front line, quote unquote. And then you get the kind of feckless liberal answer of, what, nightly applause, right? So at least we do have a kind of coalescence around the need for hazard pay and the need for a actual subsistence to get through this crisis, which is what we don't have. And it's what we talk about in the U.S. all the time. There's no quote-unquote social safety net. And why is that? Oh, because we all believe that we need to individually take care of our own business, and if you don't, you're irresponsible, and you're just not productive, and, oh, you should get a job. So now we're at the point where renting, you know, the problem with landlordism is that eventually you run out of other people's money, is what it seems like. So you now have all these broke landlords who are trying to make these emotional petitions to their tenants, and everybody else like, oh, this is how I, you know, fund my family, like you're affecting my income and blah, blah, blah. And it just kind of shows that the entire model is predatory and parasitic and based off of this extenuated future of lending that was always based on speculation about whether or not the U.S. would become productive. That came from Europe. A bunch of investors invested in a colony, and they're like, let's see how it goes. And they just kept gaming the land price until we've gotten to the stage of gentrification. And now we're at a point in which the productive labor isn't there. There's no way to produce these things that keep the numbers going. And so there's panic, and they've effectively turned on the money tap at the Federal Reserve to just print money. And all of these tax breaks and things that already existed, they're still wide open. And so we're seeing, like we talked about before, $1.5 million relief checks to existing millionaires and things like that. So this is already a racket, you know? There's no coming back from this. So the rent strike itself is an inevitability, just because there's not enough people working, period, to continue the rent prices at the way they were. And as we discussed before, all those rent prices have been based on these new private equity investment commodities that just continue to suck up tons of money because they're high yield investments. So all this money getting printed is still getting shuffled into these giant private equity accounts one way or another, because they're the quote unquote reliable investment for rich people who are scared because they see this problem too. So we're at a point where rent striking is another thing you can do straight from your home that is low impact to you physically, but has a huge impact to these people who are basing their books and accounting factors on this monthly check that comes from your labor. So it's a little bit funny because it feels like the tables have turned in a way, although the people who are not able to shelter in place and aren't currently in a home are the ones who are truly disadvantaged here. That's the bigger question, I think, in this, is that now displacement and houselessness are at the forefront of the issue, because most people don't have that existing solidarity, like you'd said. They don't have a network that they can rely on. They don't have a way to shelter in place. And that's been the fight that the Stop the Sweeps Coalition has been gunning for, and what the five demands really touch on. You know, it's immediate stopping of the sweeps that help the folks. So that I feel is kind of the linchpin, is that we are really talking about the need to move away from an economy based on profit, period. The profit won't give us what we need. So in order to get past that, we have to start talking about what work means. And now we've seen that care work is what kind of defines that value and what people do in times of crisis. So you see mutual aid networks popping up. You see people helping their neighbors. You see a lot of this rededication of time now that we don't have to commit it to labor versus home capitalist. You see people doing work for each other.
We have a caller. And I think
Well, looks like we got a caller. I hadn't even put out the number yet, but 503-231-8187 for anybody who wants to call in. We have about 20 minutes left. This is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Roland. I've got Jonathan from Portland Assembly on, my co-host. And let's see who's on the line to talk to us.
Sean.
Hi,
hey,
Sean.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody. I had a question for your guests. To what extent do you believe that this is late-stage capitalism sort of playing itself out, or is this the end product of a kind of neo-monarchist movement, like a neo-feudalist agenda that's actually reaching fruition in terms of, like, you know, starting with rolling back the New Deal, the Taft-Hartley Act, Ronald Reagan firing the air traffic controllers? Like, to what extent do you believe this is, like, spinning out of control in late-stage capitalism, or is this by design? The monarchists, the people that believe in neo-feudalism, are actually celebratory, and they're hyper-confident because they believe they've utterly disorganized the working class and poor people of this country, and, like, they're actually happy and excited to see us moving back towards monarchy, neo-feudalism, and, you know, more or less putting us back in our place. And I'll leave it there. Thanks, guys.
Good to hear from you, Sean. Yeah, I feel like Sean calls in for these topics a lot, and I appreciate it a whole bunch. It's good to have that continued conversation. I definitely hear that, and me personally, just based off of what I know about the history, because if you look at the actual history of the United States, we had straight up feudalism here, which is contested. You know, feudalism as its own existent economic strategy isn't really such a far cry from those monarchies and those warrior aristocracies of conquering an empire. So that is even a kind of interesting distinction that some people contest in the history, saying that the whole idea of chivalry as a medieval force was kind of a PR strategy for these big bands of, you know, empire militaries to kind of always terrorize people and always go out into the rural areas and basically force people to produce for the crown or what have you. So this is absolutely a continuum, especially when you start to read into the prefigurative economy here, when it was strictly based off of the triangle trade of the slave economy, and the Spanish slave trade in South America, especially Portugal, Brazil. There was an American gentry, effectively. The plantation class was preeminent here. And they were interesting, if only because they projected the trappings of wealth and aristocracy from Europe into a new, less historically contextualized class of people. That it was basically the new world. You could become the new gentry out here. And so 1500s through 1600s era in North America and South America created this investment class. And they never really went away, especially if you look at New York and other places where there's kind of that old money vibe. These are the old money guys. They're old money people. And even the kind of nouveau riche carpetbaggers in the 1800s and so on effectively were the same thing. I mean, Carnegie, was it, who, you know, when the Gatling gun came out, one of the first things they did is go turn it on the miners who were striking. You know, that's hundreds of miners shot dead, right? Like, we've had feudalism here in a violent form since the inception of the United States. And so, if anything, the neoliberal model of everyone being on their own and everybody, you know, this master of your own destiny narrative is kind of what has been used to assuage this historical class antagonism. Because if you look at the 1800s, there was a huge wave of socialism, socialist organizing, anarchist organizing, a lot of people who were actively fighting Wall Street. I mean, 1920, I believe, is when they bombed Wall Street.
This is, yeah, I just saw a program, a documentary on that. It would be actually interesting to talk about that at some point. I'm not sure now, but I actually saw that as I often see such sort of, I think, desperate acts. I saw that as actually counterproductive. It was almost like the last gasp of the movement rather than firmly embedded in a growing movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's more that there, you can see that there's just this continuum of back and forth since the inception here. And it definitely goes all the way back. It goes to, you know, the original resistance and the original fear of these owners was the slave rebellion, the Soda Rebellion. Donor Rebellion was one of the biggest ones. I mean, Nat Turner. And if you look at that history of resistance, a lot of the continuum of policing is designed around this. And so when we get this hyper-policing of gentrified spaces and this criminalization of houseless people, it's part and parcel that those demographics are extremely skewed. And it's always been this anti-blackness that drives it. And you're seeing it with coronavirus, too. Like, people who are mostly affected are black and brown, period. You know, like, those numbers are overwhelming. So it's just an extenuation of that. Like, there's no such thing as a true free economy, free market. It's always been this market makers here who make it by violence. And that's what we're seeing again. We see a whole class of protests now emerging from these people who are extremely privileged, where they're basically saying, we want violence. We accept it. It's part of the world. It's just how things are. And it's wrong and awful, and it comes directly from this eugenics belief of supremacy, and that whoever makes it is the best and will be fine. So to kind of circle back on like how this affects capitalism, we've always had a disaster capitalist mentality here. It's not even like they have to plan. They simply know that if there's enough instability, the fact that they have a lot more will give them a better chance of surviving, and that's their whole game. So it's this really dismal
right, whoever makes it is the best. If you rig the game in your favor, it works really well that way. I mean, heaven forbid, you know, we should actually, you know, eliminate all the structural advantages and actually see who really can make it.
Yeah, anyway, even still, what if we made it through solidarity? What if our entire ethic shifted away from this core? Because it definitely comes from this specific era of might makes right, where it was straight up white supremacist league and the neo-Nazi stuff, but the whole idea of survival of the fittest is Herbert Spencer, and Darwin's also kind of a racist, not to be paid attention to, but if anything, Herbert Spencer is absolutely useless, and we should get rid of that whole idea, because it's not only wrong. You look at Kropotkin and other people who have disproven that for a long time. If you look at a lot of indigenous ways and folk ways and how they recognize your part and parcel relationship to nature and respect and like continual observation, that is this weird root of Western ontology, where there's a necessary separation from nature, and the proof of that is through domination. And so we have a dominative ethic that drives this, and we need to stop. This is the time to stop.
Yeah, if there ever was one. Well, once again, let's see, we have about less than 15 minutes left on Wednesday Talk Radio. We're on the phone from our homes, me and Jonathan, and you have a few minutes left to call in.
We have Norm on the
503.
Line.
503. What's that?
Norm on the line.
Norm, go ahead. You're on the air.
All righty then. Once again, thank you for your show, Paul. You know, I use y'all at KBOO and the public affairs programming to educate myself. You know, let you educated me, and I appreciate that. And you know, I am feeling so overwhelmed that I've tried to begin as much as I can to, you know, go through my junk, you know, all the crap that I don't need that I've accumulated, and you know, to see what somebody else could use. And you know, unlike it a lot of times in my hello.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and unlike in a lot of times. Well, anyway, you know, if anybody's got an extra backpack, you know, like I did, take a walk and see if you can find anybody who appears to need a backpack. I live pretty close to downtown. People walking around with, you know, five or six shopping bags and bundles and bundles and bundles of stuff. You know, you don't have to make a big deal out of it. Say, hey, you need a backpack? They say, yeah, go for it.
Right on, dude.
And it's the only thing I know how to do. And one person with one backpack could be a lot more. I don't know. Hell, you know, I'm turning into a day drinker. It's just so weird. And anyway, I'll let somebody else have some time. Thank you for your show, Paul. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, take care of yourself and reach out, not just to KBOO, but reach out to, you know, people closer at hand if you need it. That's what we got to do.
Well, it's stressful times for everybody, and I think if anything, that brings up a good point of powerlessness that people are feeling. I will say that the explosion of mutual aid has been really impressive, if only because it has kind of invigorated that feeling of powerful connection to people. And so that it's one backpack. One backpack is absolutely the start, and that is what a lot of people can do, and it's what you have to start with. But I do think there is this mutual recognition of position that's beginning to happen. It's like, whoa, that really is just us. Like, this is starting to break down. We've talked about it for a long time in the show about how houselessness is seen as this imperative of, oh, you just don't deserve it, or you can't be trusted now, and there's this kind of disparaging nature of it because, oh, you did something to mess up, so that's why you're over there and I'm over here. But now people are realizing, like, oh no, I've been fooling myself, and we've all been fooling ourselves, and this is not actually going to be able to be functional in the future, and I'm not actually going to get my security from the system. And so there's absolutely some existential dread that comes with that, that mutual aid systems help alleviate, because you're seeing your neighbors, you're doing the right thing, you feel like, quote unquote, you're getting resources to people who need them, and you see that that is the problem. And then you see it's capitalism. That's a distribution problem. We're throwing away millions of pounds of food because they can't meet the price. You know what I mean? That's right there, that shows you where this breakdown is. It's because of pricing. It's because of capitalism. It's because of this requirement to have market exchange to get goods into people's hands. And the care ethic is changing that, and that's good. If you see it in the rent strike, you see it in these solidarity movements with workers who are not heroes, they are hostages, right? These are wage hostages. No one asked for that. They deserve hazard pay at a minimum, right? It's the same question.
Yeah, I heard on Reverend Barber was on Democracy Now! Before the show, was saying that 85% of the money from those first three so-called whatever acts of supposedly helping people out in the pandemic, 85% went to the wealthy people, which, you know, it's obviously you and I both, Jonathan, I think, share a deep-seated lack of faith in the constituted governing system that we live under. But still, I mean, I do feel for those, you know, there's people who kind of on the wave of Obama, I think, sort of got inspired to actually run for office, and some really, you know, really good people who came out of a different place than most people who run for office. You know, Cortez, and we could name them. There's really only a handful, but I really feel for them trying to negotiate the system that they're enmeshed in, and trying to actually even, you know, include some small pittance for working people in these huge, massive bills that they're, you know, so outnumbered both by the corporate Democrats and by the Republicans. But still, you wonder, I mean, what, obviously the fight isn't there, but it is also there, but we can't depend upon that. You know, I guess I'm thinking about this stuff because we just had an election, you know, some interesting small things to me. I don't know, Mike Schmidt, who, you know, doesn't seem to be a of the same stripe as the district attorney, the new district attorneys for Philadelphia a couple years ago and San Francisco, I think last year. There's a small move to actually elect district attorneys who are going to, you know, fight more for the, you know, the people who marginalized people in the system and not send so many people to prison. But he seems to be of a reformist stripe. That seemed interesting to me. Some of the other people who were elected, Carmen Rubio was elected, you know, Latinx woman to the city council. And anyway, it seems like at least at a local level, elections can matter. But what we're talking about, I think, is way deeper and more structurally important than that, the kinds of resistances you're talking about.
Well, I think you really had hit on it earlier, because I personally am very obsessed with the topic of media and representation and what it creates, and specifically the ideas that people like Adrienne Marie Brown bring up about the need for positive imagination and positive imaginaries. So this collapse of positive futurity that we want to see, those desires, these collective desires we have, require that communication. And so capitalism creates this language of exclusion through technology that disables that in a way. And it's this technological bent where it is serving this idea of the future must be protected through force. And that means that you look at things like the amount of money that goes into the military's technology versus healthcare, and it makes sense because we have that mentality that the biggest stick in the world will keep us safe. Which isn't true, because obviously the biggest sick in the world isn't going to cure you when you have a pandemic crisis, right? So all this military spending was for naught, because the lifeblood of capitalism is the lifeblood of the people running it. And so not preserving that inherently creates this imbalance, which is what everyone has said about the system for a long time, right? This is exactly what Marx said, that it's not going to be able to keep up with wages because they're antagonistic to profit, so it'll never work. And what we see in media now is this kind of control over the future of ideas, and demoralization is a military strategy. So what we can do through collective imagining is work out how those new systems will work, because recuperation, like you said, like, oh, you know, these things are just getting sucked into the system, they become another thing, like all these politicians and so on, they're resultant from the prefigured situation. So these politicians came out of people organizing much longer than they had been even trying to be a politician. So it's these emergent ideas that are driving these politicians, not the other way around.
We have a caller.
Well, let's go to our last caller. We only have a minute, so go ahead, make it quick if you can, please.
Good morning. Thanks, Paul. I have a quote from Heiner Flossbeck, who's a German economist. If we do not succeed in pushing companies back into the role of debtors, the economy cannot function without ever new state debts. So the corporations have to become debtors, and they have to pay taxes. Otherwise, the state just serves special interests or private interests, when it should be serving the public interest.
Okay, well, we got to leave it there, but thank you for that. And I'll give you the last word, Jonathan.
That, honestly, we've kind of gone in circles about it, but the whole argument for the need for a new system is that the existing parameters won't create the things we need, that you don't exist within that framework, within that belief system. It's too parochial. It doesn't have the view. And so, interestingly enough, a lot of the people who are really opposed to what's going on right now are coming from the modern monetary theory camp, and they're fighting against this idea that there's a fixed amount of money and that government austerity makes sense. So this coming wave of austerity where they're going to cut programs, they're going to privatize this because it costs too much, blah, 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 blah. They're saying, hey, look at what they did for rich people. They turned on the money tap. They already did it. It's literally that they're printing money to keep all these businesses alive. And so we don't have to use money in this way where it is scarce. It is for productive social good. Money comes from the government. You recoup it through taxation, blah, 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 blah. And I have my qualms with that, but you're seeing these very erudite, nerdy money people talking about how the inherent logic of capitalist finance is broken and how it is not socially productive because it believes that money is scarce and that we can't keep growing our social base. So there's no inherent drive to take care of the society and the organic drive that comes out of you know, living in cities and living and just being around each other. And so
okay, we got to wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Jonathan. As always, appreciate it. Third Thursday co-host. Thank you so much. One last reminder, tomorrow, 9 a.m., Portland Post Office, 1020 Southeast 7th. This is a call-out. I'm just reading from a press advisory, solidarity with postal, grocery, and hospital essential workers. Thanks again, Jonathan.
Right on. Have a good night.
Okay.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up, we have Flashpoints at 9 a.m. We can also be heard at K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM and at K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.